Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. Please note that for today's workshop, there will be no question and answer portion. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Bella, and I would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, highlights from the American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, annual meeting, Driving Knowledge to Action, Building a Better Future. And today's program is a free Cancer Connect education workshop for people living with cancer, their families, partners, caregivers, friends, and healthcare professionals. And today's program is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I would like to say just a few words about who's actually on the call. We have over 125 participants on the call today. You come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Argentina, Colombia, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And again, this program is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Novartis Oncology. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mark Criss. Dr. Criss is attending physician, thoracic oncology service, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Criss will be addressing updates on lung cancer from ASCO 2025 and managing discomfort and pain. It is my great pleasure and honor to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Mark Criss.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Messner. Thank you all for joining us today. I will do my best to, I call it, unpack the very large amount of information that the attendees left Chicago with after the ASCO meeting. I have to say, I thought there was nothing less than a dizzying number of choices of new ideas and new treatments that were presented there. And I think it, oncologists were humbled in our need to learn and put into practice the various things that were discussed there and the various advancements in care that we could make. So what I'll try to do today is, obviously I can't go over all of them, but I will do some of the highlights and talk about some of the general concepts that came through. I think the first area that where there was much discussion and new information was in the disease, the type of lung cancer, small cell lung cancer. Small cell lung cancer represents about 13% of all folks with lung cancer. It's a particularly tough illness to treat, especially when it has left the confines of the chest when it's discovered. It's not a cancer that we can find early with screening, and generally when we find it, it's either spread to lymph glands in the area of the lung where it originated or to some other site outside the lung. So we really rely more than anything for the treatment of these patients on having a good therapy, a systemic therapy, a drug that can fight the cancer everywhere in the body. Even when we don't find it spread somewhere else, we assume it might be there and go after it with treatment. Now, two drugs came up that had presentations where there appeared to clearly be an improvement in treatment. The first drug was a drug called tarlatamab. Now, the tarlatamab is different. It's a so-called a BITE, B-I-T-E. And what this drug does, it engages immune cells to fight the cancer cells. And because of that, excitement of immune cells, it brings a different spectrum of adverse effects, which I'll get to in a second. What it did show, though, and I think importantly, was that compared to approved therapies, topotecan or lurbinectedin, it gave better outcomes, shrunk more cancer, and created a longer time free of cancer, and also a longer lifespan. So clearly, this drug was helpful. Clearly, it was an improvement over topotecan and lurbinectedin. The second advancement that was presented with small cell lung cancer was with lurbinectedin, the drug I just recommended. And in this second test, lurbinectedin was not given when the cancer regrew. It was given instead along with the immunotherapy. The standard therapy for small cell lung cancer at this point is you receive chemotherapy drugs for a period of time. The chemotherapy drug is given with an immune drug, usually atezolizumab or durvalumab. And then after the chemotherapy is discontinued, after 4 or 6 treatments, you continue on the immune drug. The immune drug has clearly shown, adding the immune drug rather to chemotherapy has resulted in a longer life free of cancer and a longer life in general. However, the cancer does return. So what we were looking for here was an additional medicine, in this case lurbinectedin, that could increase the time between the end of chemotherapy and the return of the cancer with the immune drug. And lo and behold, it fulfilled that. So people that got the lurbinectedin had a longer time with their cancer under control after they finished their chemotherapy and while they were receiving immunotherapy. To me, that's a very important benefit. Again, that we have a lot of drugs that can help people when the initial treatments stop working, but we have no drugs really that have been proven to work in this space to lengthen the time of being cancer-free. So I think this was an advancement there with small cell lung cancer. Switching gears right now to non-small cell lung cancer, I think one of the major presentations there was one that talked about the use of treatments before surgery. Taking a step back, we have seen in recent years that patients that have cancer have an extent that allows them to have a successful surgery. Their lives can be improved further by the addition of chemotherapy and immunotherapy given before the surgery. So this concept of neoadjuvant therapy is used. Induction chemotherapy is another word for it. Perioperative therapy, where treatments are given before and after surgery, these have been huge developments in lung cancer for people that can have surgery. And that's probably about a third of patients with the illness. So a really a sizable portion. We've learned that the combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy are helpful for people that do not have a cancer that has one of the oncogene drivers, things like EGFR or ALK, RET, ROS, and other ones. So it's very important to use the testing for those drivers as a way of ensuring that we're recommending immune therapy and chemo to the right patients. About 60% of patients don't have a driver. 60% of patients can benefit from chemotherapy and immune treatments. But the ones that have things like EGFR and ALK, the immune treatment is not as successful, and we would want to give a special targeted therapy to those patients. For this to happen, and I'll get back to this again, it is essential in 2025 that complete testing of the tumor tissue at the time lung cancer is discovered, before surgery is done. We need to know if those oncogenic drivers are present, because if they are, we need to tailor therapy or target therapy to those drivers. But for the majority of patients that don't have those drivers, they can derive the most benefit from receiving chemotherapy and immunotherapy. This is a big change in how we take care of patients with lung cancers. I mean, usually this complete molecular testing of tumor specimens happens really only in patients that the cancer has grown back. So this is something that is a major change. It's because of that, it's going to take many years probably to make it the new standard of care. But I think it's very, very important to get this information beforehand. Now, I talked already about how we have very, very good evidence that getting chemotherapy and an immune drug can improve outcomes in people when these drugs are given before surgery. But again, only if you don't have a driver. But what about the people that do have a driver? And there are very few clinical trials that have answered that question. This year at ASCO, one of those trials that has now been completed was presented by my colleague, Jamie Chaft. And what she found was for patients that had an EGFR mutation, if they got osimertinib, Tagrisso, either by itself or with chemotherapy, their outcome was better than people that had chemotherapy alone. So the message here is, again, reinforcing what I said previously, that it is critical to get sufficient tissue at the time of diagnosis to guide the therapy before surgery and potentially after surgery as well. Now, for the person with cancer, what this can often mean is the need for time to let these test results come back. And of course, once you hear you have cancer and surgery is in your future, you want to move ahead. But sometimes it's best not to move ahead, but to wait for those results. The second thing is sometimes the results, because we don't have the results and we don't have sufficient tissue to do the testing, you have another biopsy recommended to you. And again, that's the last thing you want to hear. You've already had one biopsy. Now they're suddenly saying you need a second biopsy. But sometimes it's in your best interest to do that. When these situations come up, I urge you to talk to your physicians, the medical oncologist involved, the surgical oncologist involved, and talk through what's in it for you, for this delay, for the testing, for even another biopsy. We understand that it's tough, but I urge you to talk it through and make this best decision for you. Again, the way to get around this is when you do that initial biopsy to see whether or not cancer is present, make sure sufficient tissue is obtained to do it. And this is more of a message for the doctors right now. I mentioned about the new therapies, things like tarlatamab, and the other new therapies discussed were what they call antibody drug conjugates, ADCs. In lung cancer now, there are three of them that have been approved: trastuzumab deruxtecan, datopotamab deruxtecan, and also telizo-V. I'm not going to have time to talk about those individual drugs, but what I want to say is they present additional challenges to doctors to treat and manage the side effects they can cause. They're new drugs and have new side effects. The tarlatamab, for example, which I talked about already for small cell, that drug causes something called cytokine release syndrome, where your immune cells are, I'll call it, hyperexcited and can cause fever, can cause chest discomfort, and require additional treatments with steroids or other drugs. People are carefully watched for this. Clearly a treatment is available, but because the people are uncomfortable, something that we need to manage very carefully. The other class of drugs and different side effects are with these antibody drug conjugates. Talking about datopotamab, for example, the most prominent side effect there is a sore mouth, so-called stomatitis, and also changes in the eyes. Eyes get very dry and the cornea can be inflamed. So in addition to all the things you might worry about, lowering blood counts and the like, you also have to worry about good eye care, having the right drugs available to you to treat dry eye if it happens, and also strategies to deal with mouth soreness. So these are things that you don't necessarily think of when you're about to start chemotherapy, but when you're on some of these newer drugs, your doctor has to prepare you for them. Your doctor has to give you the tools to manage these side effects should they occur. And this is something new for them, and of course it's new for you. So hang in there with us. So to summarize the ASCO, there were many, many new therapies talked about now that are here, and I mentioned some of them during this session, but there's even more coming, which I didn't get time to get to today. It's really necessary for everybody taking care of you, doctors, nurses, physicians, assistants, nurse practitioners, to learn about these things. They're kind of new things for us. They're new drugs for us and new side effects for us. And we need to focus more and more, I'll call it, on the nuances of care. For example, we don't have a one-size-fits-all for treatments before surgery, chemotherapy or immunotherapy before surgery. We need to find out the characteristics of the cancer that you are facing to find the best treatments available. We have to know how to find those nuances, and then we have to be able to act on them. And I think it's absolutely critical to make the best choices for every single patient, and each time a treatment decision has to be made. That's the challenge your doctors face, and it's the challenge to make it clear to you that process is going on each and every time a new decision has to be made. So a lot more choices. Our job is much better. Our choices mean a longer life, but it is harder for us, and it's harder for you too. So hang in there. Ultimately, it's going to be better.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Chris. That was a stellar presentation. So much wonderful information. I think that and you're the first speaker, so you set the tone for today's program to some extent. So thank you so much. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Al Benson III. And Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson will be addressing updates on colorectal cancer from ASCO and quality of life issues. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Benson.
Thanks so much, Dr. Mesner. It's a pleasure to join everyone today. And I would also say that advances in the treatment of gastrointestinal malignancies, including colorectal cancer, represented some of the highlights of the ASCO 2025 meeting. And I'm going to focus on just a few of these related to colorectal cancer. So first, at the plenary session, the first presentation was a late-breaking abstract for a trial coordinated by the Alliance NCI Cooperative Group for patients with deficient DNA mismatch repair stage 3 colon cancer, which randomized patients to receive FOLFOX with or without atezolizumab. It was called the ATOMIC trial. Overall, pathologists are now routinely reporting the mismatch repair status from patients' tumors. Patients with deficient mismatch repair tumors represent about 15% of all individuals with colorectal cancer. These are the people most likely to respond to immunotherapy. This study showed that addition of the immunotherapeutic agent atezolizumab to chemotherapy with FOLFOX improved a 3-year disease-free survival. And therefore, this combination has become a new standard of care for this population of patients. The discussant for this abstract, Dr. Miriam Shalabi, provided an excellent perspective, including when this study was designed, 6 months of adjuvant FOLFOX was standard of care. However, currently, there are patients where 3 months of adjuvant therapy is sufficient. Thus, there may have been overtreatment for some patients in the study. Also, it is possible that chemotherapy may actually be detrimental to the effects of atezolizumab, and future studies should consider immunotherapy alone. And currently, there are trials exploring the use of neoadjuvant immunotherapy without chemotherapy before surgical consideration, which has the potential to become a strategy for those with stage 3 deficient mismatch repair colon cancer. Nonetheless, the addition of immunotherapy to chemotherapy for stage 3 patients with deficient mismatch repair colon cancer is an important consideration. I would add that this study exemplifies the importance of the NCI cooperative groups, which for decades have produced practice-changing research results. During these complicated times, it's important to send a message that increasing, not decreasing, federally funded research is paramount to maintain these successful efforts that bring new treatments for patients, which provide insights into the biology and patient perspectives and save lives. There was another practice-changing abstract presented at ASCO and now published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which described patients with resected high-risk stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancer who received adjuvant chemotherapy and were randomized to an exercise group or a health education group, and this was called the Challenge Trial. The 5-year disease-free survival was significantly longer for those who were prescribed exercise, as was the 8-year overall survival. These data build upon previous supportive preclinical and observational studies, and as such, a prescribed exercise program should be strongly encouraged now as a component of survivorship for patients with stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancer. Another abstract was an update of the study referred to as the Phase 3 Breakwater Trial, which was specifically for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer with tumors that had the BRAF-V600E mutation, which is a very specific molecular variant that occurs in approximately 10% of colorectal cancer patients. This large study compared treatment with the biological drugs encorafenib and cetuximab, which previously had shown benefit for patients with this mutation. And this study also compared encorafenib and cetuximab when combined with the standard chemotherapy regimen FOLFOX or the standard chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab. And this study showed remarkable improvement in overall survival for patients who received encorafenib, cetuximab, FOLFOX. Therefore, this regimen is now the standard of care for patients with this mutation. Another National Cancer Institute cooperative group study, CLGB-SWOG-80702, included stage 3 colon cancer patients who received standard surgery and compared 3 versus 6 months of adjuvant chemotherapy with FOLFOX with or without non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug celecoxib. Now, this study also evaluated a subgroup of patients who had blood determination of circulating tumor DNA, which remains a subject of significant research interest. It's not fully integrated in standard of care. But the study showed that individuals who are positive for circulating DNA benefited from receiving the celecoxib. Determination of circulating tumor DNA in this setting continues to be the subject of ongoing research. However, many oncologists are currently testing for the presence of circulating tumor DNA, and if positive, the addition of celecoxib after primary treatment would be a consideration. There was a recently reported study which is related to this concept of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which included patients with both colon and rectal cancer and with stage 1, 2, and 3 disease, that showed that 3 years of adjuvant daily low-dose aspirin for patients with tumors that had demonstrated what's known as a PIK3CA mutation had a more than 50% reduction in the risk of recurrence of their cancer. It is estimated that the PIK3CA mutation occurs in probably about one-third of patients, and this study does show the benefits of molecular testing of the patient's tumors, and guidelines now include the recommendation to test for this mutation and to offer low-dose aspirin for patients who have been demonstrated to have the mutation and to take such for approximately 3 years. There were a number of other abstracts, but I now would like to focus briefly on the subject of quality of life. Throughout individuals' experience with cancer, it is critical to assist in maintaining maximum quality of life at diagnosis, throughout treatment, after treatment, during surveillance, and also during the time for those with advanced disease when cancer treatment per se may not be feasible. Even what might be described as mild symptoms, such as nausea or diarrhea, can negatively affect a person's life if they occur daily or for an extended period of time. Research efforts have helped to standardize questionnaires for patients to complete, which can assist the patient's cancer team in identifying areas of concern, whether emotional or physical. In fact, many of our clinical trials now utilize these questionnaires during treatment on the trial and during follow-up to better understand symptoms that the individual may be experiencing, especially symptoms related to their treatment. Another important tool is the National Comprehensive Cancer Network Distress Thermometer, which not only has a measure for level of distress the person is experiencing, but also has a checklist identifying important concerns such as physical issues. So, for example, pain and fatigue, also emotional concerns such as fear and loneliness, as well as anxiety, social concerns in terms of relationships with family and friends, and communication with the healthcare team, and practical concerns such as ability to take care of oneself or to work, or housing or financial concerns, and also spiritual or religious concerns, the sense of purpose. There are also additional questions that you can address, which are known as social determinants of health, such as ability to arrange transportation for office visits, as well as issues centered around housing or financial distress. Another tool is referred to as patient-reported outcomes measures, and this covers five categories, which include health-related quality of life, functional status, symptoms and symptom burden, health behaviors, as well as the patient's healthcare experience. I should also highlight that important members of an individual's cancer care team include our palliative care colleagues who have extensive expertise in managing an individual's symptoms throughout the course of their illness. A final message is to emphasize the importance of maintaining communication with your healthcare team to discuss any concerns you might have about the way you are feeling or the impact cancer is having on your life and family, so that your team might suggest ways to address these very critical issues. And with that, that concludes my remarks, and I'll turn this over to Dr. Messner.
Thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That was really a superb presentation, just stellar, and you really covered incredible updates in terms of colorectal cancer from ASCO, and then your focus on quality of life issues was really quite stellar, and I'm sure very helpful to our participants. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Eileen O'Reilly, and Dr. O'Reilly is the Winthrop Rockefeller Endowed Chair in Medical Oncology, Section Head, Hepato, Pancreobiliary, and Neuroendocrine Cancers, Co-Director, Medical Initiatives, David M. Rubin Science Center for Pancreatic Cancer, Chair, Human Research Protection Program and IRB, Attending Physician, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. O'Reilly will be addressing updates on pancreas cancer from ASCO and supportive care concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. O'Reilly.
Hello, everybody. Eileen O'Reilly here, and thank you to Dr. Messner for the invitation this afternoon. I'm delighted to be summarizing what happened at ASCO 2025 in pancreas cancer. So going to start with early stage disease, look at what's happening in the locally advanced disease setting, and then a couple of topics in terms of what's coming and supportive care considerations. So moving to early stage disease, if an individual has an operable pancreas cancer, there are two main ways that's approached from the therapeutic perspective, either direct to surgery, followed by postoperative treatment or adjuvant treatment. That's an international standard, but increasingly, even when the cancer is operable today, recommendation is for neoadjuvant or preoperative treatment with the goals of trying to address microscopic disease that can't be seen on imaging and to test the biology of the cancer with treatment and time, and then followed by surgery. So that's kind of the background to a study called the Cassandra trial, which was conducted by colleagues in Italy. And this was focused on this resectable or operable pancreas cancer group of individuals where they were randomized to one of two treatment programs. One was an international standard of modified FOLFIRINOX, and the second was a combination chemotherapy regimen called PAX-G, which stands for cisplatin, gemcitabine, nab-paclitaxel, and capecitabine. They're all drugs that are used routinely in pancreas cancer. What is somewhat unique is using four together and using it in this preoperative space. So this study was designed with an endpoint called event-free survival, which, you know, is a slightly complicated description, but basically looked at a surrogate for how each of these treatment programs might do overall. And the bottom line from the study was that the PAX-G regimen appeared to be superior to modified FOLFIRINOX, and FOLFIRINOX being 5-FU, oxaliplatin, and irinotecan when administered in the preoperative setting. Side effect profiles were largely comparable, somewhat greater low blood count in the PAX-G combination treatment, and somewhat higher gastrointestinal side effects, as in diarrhea in the FOLFIRINOX group. So the study was positive, supported by higher ability to shrink the cancer, higher degrees of response as measured in terms of pathology, so the degree of impact of the treatment on the cancer at the time of surgery, and then trending positive to people overall living longer. So this is an option now in this perioperative or pre- and postoperative treatment space. Nonetheless, it's largely a chemotherapy program and remains to be seen, you know, how well that will be taken up overall. But nice to see a positive study in early phase pancreas cancer, and two more major studies are coming, one from Europe and one from the U.S., both phase three, and both comparing a preoperative approach, so a neoadjuvant chemotherapy followed by surgery, to surgery first and postoperative adjuvant treatment. So they will complete accrual in 2025, most likely, maybe a couple of years before we have a readout. So stay tuned there. So moving now to locally advanced pancreas cancer, and this by definition is pancreas cancer which involves typically multiple blood vessels, both artery and veins, and is not operable, although sometimes a percentage of people with locally advanced pancreas cancer can go on to an operation. Standard of care approaches to date are chemotherapy or chemotherapy and radiation. We saw another positive study readout called the PANOVA Free trial at this year's ASCO meeting. So this study was looking at building on standard chemotherapy, and in the setting was gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, an FDA-approved, guideline-endorsed, European and worldwide widely used regimen for localized and metastatic pancreas cancer. And it was adding in one study group the addition of tumor treating fields, or TTF fields, which are it's basically like a battery pack that a person wears for up to 18 hours a day, and it delivers sort of electrical waves that disrupt cell division, mitosis, which is cell division, and results in potential cancer cell death, and is a well sort of tolerated approach, with main discomforts being those of having to wear this pack, which is adhered to the skin and with a, it's called an array of probes, or and some skin irritation, some itching, etc. So this study was a positive readout for the addition of TTF fields to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel in localized pancreas cancer compared to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. Overall benefit was somewhat modest, but real, and it was also supported, and I think this is important, given that pain can be a significant contribution to symptom burden for individuals with locally advanced pancreas cancer. There was a reduction in pain and other supportive quality of life measures. So overall improvement in survival, but not necessarily improvement in ability to shrink the cancer. And so a lot of discussion has been focused around what does it mean with regard to the magnitude of this benefit, and what does it mean with regard to a person having to wear this device for an extended period each day. Having said all of that, I think it's nice to see progress, and we know that there's a precedent for this approach, in that it has shown benefits and has reached regulatory approval, TTF fields, I mean, in other sort of challenging to treat malignancies such as glioblastoma and non-small cell lung cancer. So we anticipate these data will be up for review with the FDA and other regulatory authorities in coming months, and look forward to seeing how that proceeds, and a lot of interest in building on the space. So now moving to later stage pancreas cancer, we saw at this year's ASCO meeting some early readouts on one of now a large number of drugs in development that are targeting KRAS, KRAS being a gene that's involved in signaling and growth and development and metastasis of pancreas cancer. It's a finding that's been known for decades, but what has changed in recent years is there are drugs that can effectively target KRAS. KRAS comes in various flavors, and there are three main subsets of KRAS in pancreas cancer. We know already that a very uncommon subset called KRAS G12C has drugs that have been approved in other cancers such as non-small cell lung cancer and are in the guidelines in pancreas cancer. And we're hopeful that drugs targeting either all versions of RAS called pan-RAS inhibitors or even what we call specific versions of RAS called mutant-specific or allele-specific inhibitors may have a major role in treating this disease. And to get to the point that one of these drugs called a G12D inhibitor was presented, early data looking at dosing, looking at safety, looking at schedule. It's an oral drug, and this has shown some promise, and this is very much aligned with what we're seeing in with other RAS inhibitors. And one of the drugs that's furthest along, a pan-RAS inhibitor, has now completed enrollment in a second-line setting, so after people have had initial treatment for metastatic disease, comparing a pan-RAS inhibitor to chemotherapy. So we're awaiting the readout of that, and hopefully we'll see us in 2026 and with this meeting next year be able to share some of those results. And then lastly, I'll mention one supportive care approach that I think Dr. Benson maybe alluding to, looking at the use of a medication supporting a low platelet count in the setting of chemotherapy for GI cancers, romiplostim. It's a drug that stimulates platelet production, and low platelets can sometimes lead to dose reductions and indeed delays of treatment. And the phase 3 study called the RECITE trial conducted in GI cancers showed that the use of romiplostim seemed to reduce the number of modifications of dosings that were required and resulted in less low platelet counts with a favorable safety profile. And it's been in our guidelines for some time, and nice now to have phase 3 data supporting its use, so I think we're going to see more use. And I'll just highlight again, knowing Dr. Benson alluded to the challenge study in colorectal cancer, but I think diet, lifestyle, and exercise have a lot of application for all cancers, but we want to be aware of this as a topic in pancreas cancer. So I'll sum up in saying some data in early stage disease, in locally advanced disease, and stay tuned for what's happening in metastatic pancreas cancer that we hopefully are going to have a new paradigm as to how we approach this disease in coming years. Thank you all for listening, and I will turn this back to Dr. Messner. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Arari. That was just a wonderful presentation, stellar in every way, and presented such wonderful information, both about new treatments for pancreas cancer as well as supportive care issues. So thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Alvaro Alencar. Dr. Alencar is Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine, Chief Medical Officer, Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, Member Lymphoma Committee at Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology Hematology Section Lead, Sylvester Global Oncology Program. And Dr. Alencar will be addressing updates on lymphoma from ASCO and communicating with your healthcare team. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Alencar.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's really an honor to be here. It's a pleasure to spend a few minutes going over some of the new bites of information on lymphoma presented at ASCO. As you know, we have our large hematology meeting called ASH that happens every December. So what ends up happening is that ASH is much larger and tends to go over every single detail. And in ASCO, which is really a meeting focused on solid tumors, what we end up seeing in at ASCO in our little corner on lymphoma are really studies that will have direct impact on what we do today. So they tend to be highly relevant clinical trials that will have direct impact on what we do for patients the day after we leave the conference room. So, and what we saw on this meeting was very interesting, was really showing where we're heading. A lot of technologies that will guide us and improve our therapies and really improve the way we treat patients with lymphoma. So in one of the sessions, there were some studies evaluating clinical and molecular markers, so tools that help us understand the disease a little better. And really, this has a very large implication of what we do today, because there's something called MRD, minimal residual disease or measurable residual disease, which is something that lymphoma has been lagging behind a little bit. And one of the main things is that sometimes you need to find one specific mutation, one specific clone that you're going to follow and you track to measure. And lymphoma a lot of times has multiple clones, which makes it a little more challenging. But we have what is called ctDNA, or circulating tumor DNA, which are pieces of DNA that these tumors release in the bloodstream. And when you detect it, it's very good in understanding if the disease is present or not. So you use this to identify tumor, you use this even to sequence them and find new mutations. But what this study really did was using this in parallel with what we use today as the standard to evaluate response in lymphoma, which are PET scans. So we know in PET scans we can evaluate the size, but also the metabolic activity of some tumors, and these are the standard that we use to evaluate lymphoma as the response and as well as the staging. So as you know, a lot of times when you have activities in PET scan, it's not necessarily activity because of that tumor, but benign things like inflammation or reaction and not really even an infection sometimes, but not necessarily active disease. And sometimes, unfortunately, we have a negative PET scan, but still have eventually the disease returning. So what we saw in this study that is evaluating the responses to therapy in first line, so patients with large B-cell lymphoma receiving an R-CHOP or EPOC or alike, so one of those standard first line regimens. And what we saw is that this MRD test, this circulating tumor DNA, was incredibly accurate in identifying disease. So in patients that didn't have it measurable at the end of therapy, very few patients had the disease return later on. And we saw this even in some patients that had a positive PET scan, if they had a negative circulating tumor DNA or was just not measured, not identified, these patients tended to do really well. And the opposite was also true. Patients that had a negative PET scan, so in remission on the PET scan, no suspicious activity, but measurable circulating tumor DNA, actually had a slightly higher risk of the disease returning. So this technology called PhaseSeq is getting into the market now, so we should have it available relatively soon. And we still have to understand how we apply this a little better, but we're seeing in the future something that might rely more on these blood tests rather than the imaging to evaluate response, so much easier for patients, not having to go through a scan, not having to get contrast. So it is very, very nice to see this finally getting to lymphoma, and we hope to be able to use more of this very soon. Then we had another session that was showing some new technologies, new techniques to treat lymphoma. So, for example, you know that CAR T cell therapy is a very hot topic in lymphoma today, and now that we've been using this for a few years, we start to learn how lymphoma escapes and how sometimes disease doesn't respond well to CAR T cell therapy. So now we're building new constructs using different targets, targeting two targets at the same time to try to avoid what we call this escape mechanism. And so we're starting to see this next generation CAR T cells, also in B cell lymphomas, but showing excellent tolerability and really encouraging responses, even in patients that had previous CAR T. So really showing that CAR T is here to stay, and as we understand it better and better, we'll be creating better and better constructs to address the disease earlier and earlier on lines of therapy. But CAR T was not the only thing we talked about. We also talked about a class of drugs that we use a lot in lymphoma called antibody drug conjugates. And we have some of these drugs available, like, for example, polatuzumab or loncastuximab in large B-cell lymphoma. And this study was evaluating a different drug called zilovertamab. And zilovertamab targets ROR1, which is a different target that is expressed in many B-cell lymphomas, and is a drug that is evaluated now in the relapsed setting. So it is being used combined with a standard chemotherapy that we use a lot called GemOx. And what we saw in this study is that the addition of zilovertamab to GemOx really gave very high response rates, much higher than you would expect with GemOx alone. And this was very well tolerated, the typical toxicity that we expect from these ADCs or antibody drug conjugates. So usually they don't have much issues, maybe some issues with low platelets, some issues with diarrhea, but in general, very, very well tolerated and very active. So we're going to see more of this drug, very likely in a randomized study relatively soon. And we're also seeing some ideas of bringing this drug up front because it's so effective in the relapse setting that we definitely need to consider this earlier on in for initial lines of therapy. So zilovertamab is a drug that you should write it down. You will definitely hear more about it very soon. Another important setting that I talk now more about large B-cell lymphoma and some of these drugs and some mechanisms like circulating tumor DNA will also trickle down to other low-grade lymphomas. But another important setting is really Hodgkin lymphoma. We have today agents that completely revolutionize the therapies like checkpoint inhibitors like nivolumab, pembrolizumab, or another ADC like brentuximab. So we do incredibly well with Hodgkin lymphoma today. Thankfully, we're able to really put the majority of patients in response in remission. So we have very effective options. But still, unfortunately, we have a few patients that will relapse. And we need new agents. We need new options. And we saw some very nice agents coming along that we're probably going to be seeing more and more for treatment of relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma. One is a drug called sintilimab, which is a different checkpoint inhibitor. It's a drug that works a little bit different and is demonstrating very appealing activity. But also an interesting drug called asintamig, which is a bispecific antibody, but it's called like a cell engager. It really brings cells, immune cells, to attack the lymphoma. And this drug was combined with a cytotoxic cell called NK cells. So a little bit of a cellular therapy, a little bit of a bispecific antibody really given together, also having incredible activity even in highly refractory Hodgkin lymphoma patients. So demonstrating that we're also seeing new drugs, new techniques for treatment of Hodgkin lymphoma, the same way that we're seeing in non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So it's really a great time. It is very nice to see that these drugs are very well tolerated, that have incredible responses, and is allowing us to use less and less of chemotherapy, even in earlier treatment lines. So these drugs tend to slowly trickle down for earlier lines of therapy, as we saw, for example, with a study with another bispecific antibody that is already approved for treatment of low-grade lymphomas, but it is approved for treatment in the relapse setting called mosunetuzumab. And we saw data for this drug used in first line and showing excellent activity, excellent tolerability without the need to use chemotherapy, which today is still the standard for treatment of low-grade lymphoma in first line. So we see more and more of these new technologies. We see more and more of these new methods of treating disease, and it's just going to make our job better, being able to cure more patients, be able to do this with less toxicity and less burdensome things for patients to do, hopefully less scans, hopefully less toxicity. So it is very, very bright. And I wanted to just stay on this topic, really spend a few minutes on talking about communication with your health team. So as we talk about toxicity, as we talk about the way these drugs are given, as we talk about the potential ways they're given, pills, IV, in the hospital, an infusions outpatient, scans, or having the option of a finite therapy that is given for a few months, or indefinite therapy that is given for a prolonged period of time. So it is so important that you communicate with your health team. A lot of times patients will hold back. They don't think it's important. They think the doctor is too busy, doesn't have time for these smaller things. But the reality is quite the opposite. The team is there for you, and the more we know about you, the more we know about your wishes, your concerns, the best we can plan the therapy, because we're so lucky to have all these different options and different settings, and understanding the patient's wishes, the thoughts, the plans are so critical to decide which therapy fits best. Because a lot of these agents will give us very similar responses, but in a different way. If we don't understand what is your priority, if we don't understand how previous therapies went, because a lot of times patients don't want to share some toxicity because they're concerned that we may adjust the dose or stop the therapy and they feel like it is working really well. So we need to work as a team. We really need to have that information. You need to communicate with your team, with your doctor, to be able to help us in making these decisions. And it's important not only to talk to your cancer team, to your cancer doctor, but also all other specialists. We have to be in alignment, because those old ages of chemotherapy with low counts and infection and nausea, vomit, diarrhea are really part of the past. Now we have drugs that activate the immune system using cellular therapies. So the mechanism that these drugs work is different. The toxicities are different. And sometimes some side effects may not be so familiar for some other specialists. And it may be happening right in front of them and they just can't identify. So if you don't have a good communication with all these different doctors, with all these different teams, some of these things may be missed. Or we may have another drug being added that doesn't really go very well with what we have in mind, and we may have unnecessary toxicity that could have been avoided. So it is so, so important that we have great communication all the time. And as this happens, as we talk about communication, I keep saying team, team, because I know the doctor is still a very important member in the cancer team, but it's really a multidisciplinary care. And we're so thankful to have an enormous team that helps us provide the care. Our nurses, our nurse practitioners, our pharmacists, our social workers, and this goes on and on and on and on. So when we're talking about communication, it is critical that we think about communication with the team. Because we, the team, will be also in constant communication. We're discussing every patient. We'll make sure that we have an aligned response and an aligned action for whatever problem we may have. But you don't have to be overly concerned if you're not talking directly with your doctor, because the doctor will ultimately be the main player, the one that we're making the decisions, but it is important that you align your communication with your team overall. Dr. Mazin, I'd like to thank you once again for this opportunity. I hope this was very helpful.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Alan Carr. This is incredibly helpful and very informative in terms of the treatment of updates on lymphoma and also the whole discussion about the communication with the healthcare team. So very important. So thank you so much. Excellent, excellent presentation. Outstanding. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow, and Dr. Morrow is Director, Chronic Myeloid Leukemia Program, member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Weill Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Morrow will be addressing updates on leukemia from ASCO and managing treatment side effects. It's my pleasure now to turn over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Morrow.
So thank you, Carolyn, for that kind introduction, and I'm glad to join you all today. to speak about what we learned at ASCO 2025 related to leukemias. And as has been historic, you know, ASCO is a meeting where we see a lot of research on many different cancers, probably more of an emphasis on solid tumors, as we call them, or non-blood cancers. But we certainly learned quite a bit, and we've had some really nice advances in the treatment of blood cancer. Specifically, we think about AML, or acute myeloid leukemia. Historically, we used to treat AML in the hospital with intravenous chemotherapy as our strongest and most comprehensive treatment, with good results, but obviously with a lot of side effects. And we've had really a revolution in AML, using medications that allow us to treat at least part out of the hospital, perhaps part in the clinic, part at home, or part out of the hospital, with newer medications. A combination of a group of drugs called hypomethylating agents, the two names of the drugs are azacitidine and decitabine, combined with a medication called venetoclax, which has been borrowed really from the treatment of lymphoid cancers, but now is that medication has proven to be helpful across the blood cancer spectrum and other diseases as well. So the combination of azacitidine and venetoclax really has revolutionized the treatment of AML, particularly for people who are older or who have more risk of side effects. And in a trial called the VIALE trial, the VIALE-A trial, that combination was approved for use for AML. But at ASCO, we saw a report on an alternative way to deliver those types of medications in an even better way. So azacitidine and venetoclax would require someone to come to the clinic for probably at least a week per month to get an injection or an IV treatment, combined with oral medication. So most of it could be delivered at home, but not all. And the study was a comparison between that and an oral medication called Inqovi, which is oral decitabine and with the same venetoclax medication, so an all-oral regimen. And the results were quite encouraging. It was a study done cooperatively with many different cancer centers participating, and we saw that the all-oral combination, which could in theory be delivered all at home, all out of the hospital, was as effective as the regimen which was given at home, which is terrific. That is a nice advance for patients to be able to get induction for AML or, you know, to induce a remission in AML with an all-oral regimen. We've really come a long way in AML, and I was delighted to see that. In other news, the same combination, now not the oral regimen, but still back to the regimen, which is given at least part in the clinic. Different ways of dosing these two drugs has also been shown for patients with AML who have a particular type of AML. It can be very difficult to treat. There's a mutation we see in blood cancers and also solid tumors called P53. P53 is called a tumor suppressor gene. Not surprisingly, if there's a mutation, alteration, or that gene is missing, let me remind us of the name, tumor suppressor gene. If the tumor suppressor gene is altered or missing, tumors may be more likely to grow or persist or relapse. So when we see blood cancers like AML with that mutation, they're more difficult to treat. So investigators and who reported at ASH, the last author has a very catchy name of Goldfinger. This is known as the Goldfinger regimen, if you will, gave the drugs in much lower doses with a different goal. Instead of trying to overwhelm the cells and perhaps directly cause them to die, it was trying to move them into cell cycle, or what's called differentiate them. So a little bit different approach, a gentler dose of chemotherapy with a different end in mind. And patients with TP53 mutated leukemia, or AML that is, or MDS, which is really pre-leukemia, got this what's called metronomic or low dose cycling of these drugs, once a week really, dose of each of the drugs. And the response rates were very impressive in this early study. Not all patients were assessable, meaning not everybody had a bone marrow study or could follow through on the treatment altogether. But of those who did, the majority of patients had a complete remission in AML. Roughly half of patients with myelodysplasia did, and more than half of patients didn't need transfusions, having needed them before. So these are really important endpoints for pre-leukemia and leukemia in a very difficult population using a lower-dose chemotherapy regimen. That's got all the right direction in my mind. And I think it was very wise, to explore this angle or approach. Okay, following on this theme, the medication venetoclax is very good, was borrowed from lymphocytic leukemia, and now is quite helpful in myeloid leukemia. Are there any new versions of that drug? Do we have anything new? What if you didn't go into response or remission with that drug? So a company called Ascentage has developed a drug called lisastoclax, or APG-2575. And at ASCO, there was an early study looking at that medication combined with the azacitidine I mentioned. So all of these three studies use the same types of combinations of medications. And this looked at patients with a broad array of blood cancers who had either had this drug, venetoclax, and it didn't work, or perhaps they hadn't had it, and maybe odds would have been good or not as good to respond, to see how this newer version of what's called a BCL-2 inhibitor would work. And the results were also encouraging here. Now, an early study is looking to see what side effects happen and the safety and so on. But with regards to response, we had in patients with lower grade, we call them, or more chronic blood cancers like MDS or a form of MDS called CMML, we had an overall response in more than half of patients with complete remission and marrow complete remission. In leukemia or AML treated with this regimen, and the abbreviation or the tag name for this drug is catchy, it's called Lisa, as if it's a person. If it was treated with Lisa, they had upwards of half of patients responding, and as well, patients who had exposure to the typical form of this drug, venetoclax, and had not responded to it, even there they saw about 1 of 5 patients could respond. So again, very encouraging use of an alternative of the drug we currently use now. So as you can see, a lot of good news, a lot of smart approaches to the treatment of higher grade blood cancers using a combination of drugs in different ways, oral forms, better for patients with lower side effects. I'll move in the last two studies to a study for lower intensity blood cancer like myelodysplasia. Now here, one of our early interventions would be to stop transfusions from being necessary or to reduce them. And in a previous study, the drug called luspatercept, which interferes with the inflammation and the abnormalities that drive anemia in myelodysplasia, has been already shown in a trial called the COMMANDS trial to be better than medicines we still have available and used to use called erythropoietin or ESAs. And at ASCO, we saw a long-term follow-up of that drug showing that, first off, about 3/4 versus half of patients using the other drug were able to stop needing transfusions over a period of 12 weeks. So that was a nice margin of improvement. In this follow-up study, we saw that the overall duration of that response and the good outcomes were extended. So more confidence in this drug luspatercept in being a better way perhaps to treat anemia and have someone become transfusion independent, which of course is a very good thing. My last study I'll talk about is my favorite disease called CML, which we've had very good news with the approval of the drug asciminib. And that drug was approved for later patients with CML who had had previous treatment. We had a very important study called the Ask for First study, which showed that asciminib for newly diagnosed CML is essentially better than all of our other agents that we use, imatinib, nilotinib, dasatinib, bosutinib, and also has a lower side effect profile, so remarkable. That led to the asciminib being approved for first treatment for chronic phase CML, and that is my recommendation for patients with CML to seek that medication. So at ASCO, we saw another important study called the Ask for Start trial, which was a comparison between asciminib and specifically the drug nilotinib or Tasigna, which is a very good medication that's been approved for a while, but may have some more side effects. And they took an approach where they said, let's of course look to see how well patients did, but let's also measure carefully how long might it take for patients to have to need to stop their medication because of a side effect. And indeed, asciminib was much better and had a much longer time and much lower rates of adverse effects. So the time to an adverse event leading to discontinuation was unfortunately higher with nilotinib or Tasigna. The likelihood that asciminib was better was statistically significant, and the number of patients who had discontinuation due to side effects was less than half. So I think we have two messages with asciminib, that not only is it more effective, but it has lower side effects. And that's very important for a disease we treat over a few years' time and in whom we may be wanting to treat as perfectly as we can to potentially achieve what's called a treatment cessation or treatment-free remission. So at ASCO, we learned a lot about acute leukemia and chronic leukemias, and we have this theme of using drugs smarter that are safer and better, and I'm delighted to have been able to report that to you. In the last few minutes, I just want to emphasize something that's very important. As you can see in these clinical trials, a lot of the endpoints were side effects, and were they better, and what did we learn? So if you're in a clinical trial, or if you're just being treated, one of the most important things we can do is not only watch how well cancer treatment can go, but pay attention to side effects, because the treatment is not going to be successful if side effects are interfering. How do we do that? Managing side effects is a multifaceted approach or multifaceted task. First off, we need great communication between the physician and their care team, the nurse practitioner, even just the frontline folks in the office to hear that someone needs a call back or is having trouble and needs to manage a side effect. If we don't know, we can't help. Doctors need to listen and to be open-minded, and patients who are under treatment or family members need to try to take an inventory if they can, write things down, take notes, even keep a diary so things are not forgotten and details can be explained about when and how strong and what was done to try to fix it so we can troubleshoot. That's how we operate in clinical trials. We ask folks to keep a diary or we list things, and it really makes a difference. But again, open communication, attention to detail, and then honesty. I think we all want to be successful with what we're doing. And if we're sort of trying to bite our lip to say, I'll just see if I can make it through, the worst thing that can happen is the treatment is going well, potentially, but the success is diminishing because the treatment is being skipped or held or stopped. And for example, in chronic myeloid leukemia, in the space I work in, one of the most common reasons why someone might unfortunately have had a loss of response, it may be because side effects are interfering and they needed to stop treatment and they haven't been able to discuss it or they didn't want to discuss it. So to wrap up, I think, managing side effects is a team approach. It's definitely completely dependent on dialogue. We have a host of medications to address all the side effects we can see, ranging from nausea and GI side effects, which are some of the ones we think are most common, to fatigue and feeling like you're in a fog and a host of physical manifestations. Tell your provider team your history, let them know everything that's going on, keep an open dialogue, and we can be as successful as we possibly can. And these clinical trials are really showing us that we have a great direction occurring. Thank you for your attention, and I'll pass it back to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow. That was just an outstanding presentation. I'm stellar in every way. Wonderful to hear the updates about treatment of leukemia and also just your focus on managing treatment side effects and how important it is to discuss these side effects with your healthcare team. So thank you so much. Thanks for a wonderful presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Gregory Daniels, and Dr. Daniels is professor of medicine, UC San Diego Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Daniels will be addressing updates on melanoma from ASCO and a wrap-up of part two of highlights from ASCO. Dr. Daniels has been on for the entire call, and he is going to do a wrap-up of what we've all learned from the program today. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Daniels.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Messner, and to Cancer Care for organizing these, and everybody for making it through and listening to some of the exciting stuff at ASCO. And I will first briefly discuss melanoma. As is always the challenge, how do we condense a international meeting with literally 10,000 different presentations and bring it down into a understandable format? It's daunting, but I will kind of walk through early detection, which affects pretty much all of us in skin cancers. It's always been a little bit of a a challenge, say, in colorectal cancer to get people in to do a colonoscopy or a stool check. It shouldn't be a challenge to have people look at their skin, but it is. And some of that is access to expertise to evaluate a lesion. Our simple mnemonics that we embark on patients, you know, see spot change, see a dermatologist, is sometimes not realistic. There can be access to healthcare, especially in, unfortunately, still in 2025, and maybe that access is going to get worse for a certain population. And so there is the general population, and then there's the more vulnerable population. To try to address this, Dr. Susan Sweater at Stanford University has been organizing an effort to look at barriers to getting people in and assessed for skin cancers. And she presented some of her thoughts and some of the work being done using AI tools to increase access and increase the accuracy of a diagnosis. Because when you look at a spot, it is pretty challenging to tell if that spot is something you should be worried about or not. And so over-diagnoses and under-diagnoses, and how do we continue to modify this was the focus of our presentation. So pretty exciting because we know for sure that early detection saves lives in melanoma and just in general for all cancers. If we can find things earlier, treat earlier, bring back or down the stage of a cancer, then the outcomes are better. So it was nice to see at ASCO really discussions like that. In addition to early detection, there's prevention. You know, I'll just highlight the note for colorectal cancer in linking exercise and better outcomes for patients that are high risk for relapse. And just in general, we know that diet and exercise plays a role. It's just been really a challenge in trying to document that in a useful way for people to digest and apply to their lives. And so there was a study out of MD Anderson looking at the impact of dietary fiber on the outcomes of immune therapies for patients with melanoma. And this was a Herculean challenge to try to get it down to as best as possible one variable that you could look at and then measure an outcome of response. And so this took really an institution with the resources like MD Anderson and years to accrue patients and to modify that one part of their diet as best that they can in terms of dietary fiber, and showed that their hypothesis was correct, that using dietary fiber, which, you know, there's lots of scientific speculation, maybe it's impacting the microbiome of the gut, and that modulating that can improve outcomes with immune therapies, or chronic immune therapies. So early detection, some aspects of prevention, it was nice to see at ASCO. In general, ASCO highlights both where we are today, so the current clinical trials, and where we're going for all the fields. In melanoma, we've had for a while two pillars, that's immune therapies and targeted therapies. But on the targeted therapy side, where approximately half of the skin patients have a mutation that we have a matched drug for, the other half don't. And so what we saw at ASCO was really bringing forward a bunch of candidate medications that target things that heretofore we just haven't been able to effectively target. So that was foreshadowed, as well as some novel therapeutics. Again, mentioned in some of the other other talks have been these antibody-drug conjugates, which are tools that we can use to target the cancer cells more specifically in the hopes of decreasing toxicities. And so some of that was foreshadowed. As far as the today and the now, what did we learn that's kind of impacting our care? So adjuvant therapy is treatments that we use to decrease the risk of recurrence. We use adjuvant therapy in what we consider high-risk situations. That's anybody with a diagnosis of stage 3 or stage 4 where surgical efforts have cured the patient, but we suspect that the cancer has a high chance of coming back. Today, we use immune therapies such as pembrolizumab or targeted therapies if there's that match. And we can show that we decrease the risk of recurrence by using these therapies. However, we're always trying to do better. A study was done looking at a combination of immune therapy, the Relativity 098 study by Dr. Long, and that was a combination of two medications to target two different immune checkpoints versus one, which is the current standard of care. And it was clear that combination was not better. And why am I highlighting a negative study? And that's because we have a lot of good ideas and we have a lot of good tools that we've used in experimental models such as mice or tissue culture, but until we take it and have it undergo that more or less reductionist approach where we try to ask, does X do better than Y, and do it in an unbiased way as possible, we don't really know sometimes the value of our therapies. And while we are collectively all kind of smart people, we get it wrong. And that's the value of these clinical trials, to tell us, hey, hold on a second, that good idea wasn't so good. And so I think it is important to emphasize negative studies as well as the positive ones. In advanced disease, that's people where surgery is not possible, the efforts trying to better identify patients, because, again, not everybody needs everything, so trying to identify patients up front that might need less therapy than others, and strategies to decrease toxicity. I'll highlight one trial which was looking at inhibiting one of the molecules we think mediates some of the toxicities, however, is less important in impacting the benefit of the immune therapies, and that's IL-6. I'll call, there's been many, many people that worked on this, but I'll call out Jeff Weber, who was instrumental in putting forward some of these ideas, and a study was presented looking at a pretty aggressive regimen of immune therapies that is known to have a lot of toxicities. That's ipilimumab, nivolumab, relatlimab, so what we would call triple immune therapy. But in addition, they were blocking the IL-6 receptor. And there in this phase 2 study strongly suggested that the activity was preserved, but several components of the toxicity were less. So this is a pretty exciting area for us right now, because while some of our therapies can cure patients with metastatic melanoma, there are a lot of toxicity risks that patients experience. So if we can figure out how to lower the toxicity without impacting that benefit rate, that's a big focus. I will highlight another one, another study that I think really continues to be practice informative. That's called DreamSeq. DreamSeq was Michael Atkins' efforts through the cooperative groups. Cooperative groups have been mentioned before. What is that? That's the National Cancer Institute and the NIH supporting these clinical trial activities where we all need to collaborate to answer pretty valuable but tough questions. And when I say tough, I mean taking 1,000 patients, 2,000 patients, et cetera, and coordinating this across the country. So the infrastructure for that exists to answer questions such as DreamSeq posed, which is, if I have a therapy X and I have a therapy Y, doesn't matter if I give it in one order, X first, then Y, or Y first, then X. And the reason that's important is both therapies have benefit, but we should at least ask the question, does the order matter? And of course, in DreamSeq, the orders significantly matter. If we give targeted therapies before immune therapies to the majority of patients in first-line treatment, and we treat them to the point where they become resistant to those immune therapies, then they do less well than starting with immune therapies and doing it in the reverse order. And when I say less well, I mean overall survival less well. So huge impact, seminal study that really should inform the field and spill over to other fields to ask some similar questions about sequencing of our therapies, because as we get more and more therapies, these will be important. I'll just maybe I'll finish melanoma there and go back to my second task, which was to summarize everybody, which is impossible, of course. But the themes that I will pick out is that research. Maybe you guys, public is tired of hearing about the importance of research, but when I have a patient in front of me, I really appreciate the value of having data in front of me that says there is a X percent chance of this happening and a Y percent chance of that. Now, certainly, it's up to us as physicians to apply those data sets to an individual patient and to translate that into something, but at least I start with some knowledge. And throughout the presentations, you heard about, you know, new molecules coming up, different ways of looking at quality of life, trying to improve the outcomes for patients, and all that is clinical trial data that we just take back and improve our practices with. And to support the point of advocacy, as the political climate is changing and research is de-emphasized in some points, I do think everybody should think about really the incredible resource that we have in the United States of medical research. And I hope that the importance of that can get communicated better. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, thank you, Daniel. That was just a wonderful presentation, still in every way. And actually the fact that you've actually been able to do the updates on melanoma, but also that you listened to the entire, all the presentations and were able to think about the importance of research in this country, and the fact that that you need to advocate to have as much research as possible so that the clinical trial of today becomes the standard of care tomorrow. So it's really important for all of you listening today also to participate in clinical trials. Thank you so much, Dr. Daniels. So appreciate your doing this wrap-up. And I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services for everybody. This has been a really amazing program. I just want to let you all know that Cancer Care is a national organization that provides free programs and services to people throughout the country. And so what do those services consist of? Well, we provide nationally both practical, financial, and co-payment assistance to people throughout the United States. We also have a helpline. It's an 800-813-4673 number, staffed by oncology social workers and navigators who will address your questions. We also have a website, www.cancerk.org, where you can listen to all the new, we have so many online support groups, and so to go over them all on the phone would take forever. So if you go to the website, you'll be able to see all the online support groups that we offer, both for older adults, younger adults, every different community, men, women, children, young adults. So services for everybody. And we also, of course, offer these Connect education workshops and, of course, publications as well as patient navigation. So with that being said, just take a look at these things. Call our helpline if you have concerns. And I know we have a number of international participants on the call today. You may visit our website to see what we are offering. And again, I want to thank everyone for your participation today, both our speakers as well as all of our participants today. It's been a phenomenal call, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all, and thank you all, and have a great day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.